The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702, your number one news and talk station.
Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual. Do great things. Welcome to The Money Show. Ian Moyer, Chief Executive of Woolworths, standing by. Talk to him in just a moment. Have all the sweets disappeared out of the aisles? I was in a Woolies the other day, and there was a noble effort full of nuts and dried fruit, but they don't seem to have really grasped the nettle there yet. We'll talk to him about that this evening. He's been warned. Michael Mark, Chief Executive at Truworths. We also speak to the CEO of City Lodge, Clifford Ross. If you're a hotel owner, what are you doing about water consumption in drought areas? I know the Vaal Dam is filling up, and it's sitting at about 64% or thereabouts, but by the end of winter, it's going to be low again. What a hotel group doing on a national basis, especially Cape Town's supposed to have 134 days of water left. It's a concern. Warren Ingram is going to talk to us about couples and money, contentious issues, and of course then another issue to do with money is small business. Pavlo Fatidis, about making sure that you get paid once you deliver your service, and then you want to demand payment, but then you don't want to upset your customers. Really difficult as a small business. Big one. We'll take your stories around that as well. And then what exactly did the banks do wrong when it came to the foreign exchange trading business with currency trades? We'll get that broken down for you this evening as well.
The Money Show.
Your number one news and talk station.
I see the IDC is taking over the National Empowerment Fund. It makes sense. People I talk to have dealt with the IDC have got far better things to say about it than the National Empowerment Fund. They're calling it a merger. They say it'll promote increased broad-based black economic empowerment in, as stipulated in the President's State of the Nation address, a specific focus on promoting black industrialists. I think there's a lot of shrapnel about in terms of funding and funding options, and the IDC has been pretty effective. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the IDC has been pretty effective in terms of getting money to where it needs to be. Woolies under pressure after a tough 2016. It is our stock picker's favourite share for 2017, despite falling very, very sharply in recent months. Ian Moyer, Chief Executive at Woolworths, on the line to us from Cape Town this evening. Both of the economies where you're operating right now, Ian Moyer, are pretty tough, both Australia and South Africa.
Yeah, they are. There's no doubt about that, Bruce. Both markets are in similar conditions for slightly different reasons. If I look at South Africa, the consumer's finding it tough where we don't have any growth. Retail's affected. The amendments to end the National Credit Act didn't help. So it's been a difficult 6 months for all of us. We're doing the best we can in that environment. We've taken market share. We're growing our business. If I look at Australia, highly promotional, a lot of structural change as well as cyclical change, consumer sentiment a bit soft at the moment. So it's been a difficult trading period for the business as a whole. But, I think we're focused on the right things and doing the right things and continuing to take market share, best you can hope for in a downturn.
I mean, you dominate the top end of food. Of course, it's always your star performer. It was again last year. I find it interesting, though, that you're doing more and more buying. Is this of food as well as things like clothing in more SADC countries?
Food's always been predominantly out of South Africa. So 90% of our food offer comes out of South Africa. 54% of our clothing comes out of SADC. Clothing, we've had a real push to get more of our product out of South Africa. One, because of the rand, and two, because it gives us fast response so we can be more fashionable and more quick to respond to consumer requirements. So it's worked both ways. But certainly it's been a very positive change. And if you look at one of the things we've been able to do is keep that our inflation in clothing down. So we've been very competitive against the marketplace. So if you look at our result relative to others, our turnover has been higher than most, and our inflation has been lower than most.
Now, I mean, necessity becomes the mother of invention. The weak rand this time last year forced you to operate differently. Is it sustainable, or is it, do you remain flexible? I mean, it suddenly becomes cheaper to get your T-shirts from China again. Off you go back to China. You've got to be flexible, surely.
Yeah, we've got to be flexible. But up to a point, Bruce, you need to stay loyal to your supply base. You can only build relationships over a period of time. And the move to South Africa, we had to make sure we were able to get quality product on a consistent basis, which we've done. There's been good investment in the South African industry. You know, it's better. It's got better capital equipment, and it's got more expertise coming in. So we're able to do that. But it's also because we want that fast response, because we need to be more fashionable with our clothing offer.
I mean, so Country Road and Trinery and Witchery, which is made all over the world but comes via Australia, via those brands in Australia, that's all still being sourced globally. What are you making in South Africa then? Are we seeing a resurgence of a textile industry?
There's something of a resurgence there, Bruce, and you were talking earlier about the IDC, you know, and we are seeing the government investing more, and it is having an impact, and we are seeing better equipment, and we've increased our purchases from South Africa by 10% this year. And, you know, we're now at 30 million units a year from South Africa, which, you know, there's obviously advantages to our business, but there's a knock-on effect in that, you know, it's increasing jobs and is good for the economy overall.
Is it my imagination as I look around Woolworths, particularly the large format stores, I see more of a department store feel, maybe a greater focus on things like cosmetics. I saw you making some commentary around that coming into the larger format stores.
Yeah, I mean, we've always been trying to build our beauty business because we're underrepresented. We've got, you know, 3% market share, which is really a quarter of what it should be, you know, if you look at our clothing business as a whole. And the thing that was holding us back is we just couldn't get a deal with Chanel and Estee Lauder, which are, you know, if you don't have those brands in your business, you don't have a beauty business. But now we've got those, you know, we can have a really credible beauty business. It will bring more feet in, and it's a very profitable business for us. So we are very excited about that.
I mean, that's interesting, because as you're going more departmentalized in Woolies, if my reading of it is right, your Australian business, David Jones, you're looking to make look a little bit more like Woolies, and you're looking to introduce food into the mix there. And I saw you quoted in the Sydney Morning Herald saying you want to revolutionise food shopping in Australia. You're looking to pick a fight.
Look, you know me, Bruce. I never look to pick a fight. But I don't think I ever said we're seeking to revolutionise food. It's amazing how you get misquoted. But I think we can do something special. Just something I want to correct. We're not trying to departmentalise Woolies. Woolies okay. Are always going to be private label. But I think food, and the way Woolies does food, can certainly be used to great effect in Australia, because nobody does that.
Yeah, I mean, you've got big rivals in the food space in Australia, Coles, and ironically, another big rival there is called Woolworths. They're in the food business. So David Jones looking to take on Woolworths in Australia and Coles?
No, they're great big beasts, and, you know, they're very focused on the volume end of the market. We're not going to try and sell bags of peas and tins of beans and compete with Woolies. We're going to be something completely different. It's top end, it's fresh, it's prepared, and it's all about food service. So cafes, restaurants, champagne bars, coffee bars, it's that type of interactive food that we'll be doing, not supermarket shopping.
Does anybody at David Jones remember the year 2000, a business called Food Chain, which lost them $120 million back then, Australian dollars? Lessons from that, perhaps, before you go in?
Yeah, fortunately they are, and we have learned our lessons, and we've gone back and looked at that business, and why did it go wrong, what did they do? What we're proposing is something that's completely different to that, and very much integrated, and more of the things I've talked about than really trying to sell food and sell it independently of the stores.
Something that I've noticed, I mean, you stand in go to the old wall of death, the sweet aisle at Woolies before the tills. Was it 2 years ago? You said, we're going to eradicate that. And you see attempts as you go through Woolies aisles to try and sort of adjust it. But it doesn't seem to be gone just yet. Is it still a focus? Is it still a commitment?
No, we've taken sweets out of the aisle. And it actually had a negative impact on revenue for us, but it was the right thing to do. Our you weren't the only one that called it the wall of death. Was that what you called it?
I did. I know anybody with small children sitting in the trolley, their arms stretch. It's amazing.
Yeah,
they're very elastic.
They weren't happy about it. And, you know, we actually responded to customers and our belief of what the right thing to do and what the healthier, you know, provide healthy alternatives and take that temptation away. And as I say, it cost us money, but it was the right thing to do.
Have you? But you haven't managed to make up that lost revenue then as a result of that. You've still got to, my sense is you've still got to hit a formula, get the right formula in.
Yeah, that's actually dead right, Bruce. We've sort of been playing around with that, and you know, we've learned some lessons as we go, and it's really difficult to get the drive aisle offer right. We think we've got the right offer, the right balance, and the right categories, and we'll launch that shortly. But if I'm being honest, it was very difficult to replace the offer because it was successful. It was just all too tempting.
Well, that's the trouble with that's what was good business. Ian Moyer, Chief Executive of Woolworths, on the line just from Cape Town this evening. Fascinating stories about Woolworths, the way it is evolving and the way in which they're going to evolve the David Jones business in Australia. You would have seen David Jones products, clothing on the floors of Woolworths. If you do some clothing shopping at Woolworths, they've got Trenery in there, they've got Witchery, they've got Country Road. So lots of Australian-inspired stuff, and there's a nice crossover between the two. The big lesson for what they're going to do in Australia, where they make 42% of their profits, if memory serves, is going to be taking the South African food experience and moving that into Woolworths and what seems like an even more upmarket effort. They've employed a guy from Marks and Spencer in the United Kingdom to do that in Australia. And who knows, if they get it right there, they might bring some of the top-end experiences into Woolworths in South Africa too.
The Money Show.
The markets.
Well, the insider trading investigators are going to have a very busy day at the JSE tomorrow as they try and figure out what on earth happened to the share price of Murray and Roberts. Up 33% on the day. Something like 19% of all of the shares in issue were traded. And nobody seems to know exactly what is going on. Some of the speculation is that they've won a contract, Graham Kerner, with the Kerner perspective, to build Donald Trump's wall between Mexico and America. That's being discounted, though. I've spoken to high authorities, and they say it's not true. But here's one from an email from Mike. He says, I want to launch the story that they've been awarded a chunk of a Mozambican gas development since Mozambique recently gave the go-ahead to Shell and Anadarko for fertilizer diesel from gas and a 250-megawatt gas-fired power station. That'd be a nice seg for Clough as it finally winds down the Australian Gorgon project. Total speculation, says Mike, but at least there is a basis in fact. Whatever it is in the world of Murray and Roberts, it's got to be significant.
It's got to be so significant, Bruce, and it's got to be investigated if a share price moves on massive volume like that. So the price moving up 30% and almost 20% of the register. Normally you'd say, well, that sounds like a mistake, finger trouble. But clearly, if a share price is moving with no news, then and something positive comes out in terms of a contract, it's got to be investigated, and clearly there would be strong grounds for insider trading.
Yeah, multiple trades, huge volumes of trade. It's not like somebody hit a button and bought a million shares by mistake at 33% more than the ruling price. Something is brewing at Murray and Roberts, and the rest of the construction sector was actually quite buoyant on the day. But the big one was that mystery move in Murray and Roberts. Now, Graham, the market in positive territory, the currency moving quite a lot stronger. We are close to 18-month best levels. Any bets on the currency? I know it's the worst question in the world, and I know how much you like it, but the currency environment seems to be changing very, very quickly in our favor.
Yeah, Bruce, I think the commodity markets have obviously been quite supportive. I think there's a growing sense that South Africa incorporated GDP growth is going to be a little bit better. And the truth of it is we probably, if you look at emerging market currencies, one of the more appealing. If you think about Brazil, Russia, Turkey, people saying, well, crikey, we'd rather own South African bonds and South African assets than maybe some of those. So I think there's a little bit of that. And then also, I think a lot of people are quite fearful. You look at what's going on in France. Do you want to own euros? There's still so many unknowns in the UK around Brexit. And I think, generally people very, very concerned or unsure about what the Trump administration's actually going to do. So I think it's sort of just playing into the hands of emerging markets generally, and the Rand obviously a natural beneficiary. But if you just look at what world markets have done over the last while, to just take the Dow as an example, it's up almost 30% on a one-year view. So clearly there's a lot more optimism around, and maybe South Africa is seen as almost a call option on that. And again, you look at the incredible run in iron ore, you saw it in Kumba's results, This might be people saying, well, one and one is three, because if China's importing all this iron ore, they're tooling up for something. Let's assume there's not a, you know, we don't slip on a banana peel courtesy of the Trump administration's trade policies. People sort of thinking, well, maybe there's a, you know, these green shoots in the South African economy and might actually be real.
Okay, well, we live in hope. I mean, so many South African companies that have made big international acquisitions in the last year or so are really licking their wounds in terms of the fact that it cost them a lot more than they would have had to pay today in rand terms. And also, the profit translations that they're getting from pounds or dollars or euros or whatever it is that they bought are smaller than they might have anticipated a year ago. And one of those companies is Truworths. It made a big acquisition last year of a company called Office, and I'm talking to Michael Mark in a bit.
Yeah.
But Michael Mark's in good company. I mean, Brait and others have been burned badly.
Absolutely right. And I remember at the time, I mean, you know, almost all the retailers have sort of tried the international expansion thing. And, you know, particularly those who are going into the UK, including Brait, you sort of feel that the timing really couldn't have been worse. But I think, you know, there are lots of moving parts, obviously, in Truworths. But when you actually go and look at it, you know, Office itself, the sales were, let's call them flat, mildly negative. Now, that's not a great story, but I think the real Truworths story is the fact that, you know, headline earnings were down 3%, and yesterday we got Stats SA telling us inflation is at 6.6%, so in real terms, that's down almost 10. Lots of explanations, but when you just look through the divisional sales, you know, there's really nothing to cheer about, and the reality is you've got a fair amount of inflation, even higher than the numbers I'm talking about, and it's not just true for Truworths, it's obviously for Woolies and Foschini and everybody else. Mm. And that tells you just how poorly they're performing, you know, on a volume basis. So I must be honest, I think a lot of people are saying, well, maybe the bad news is in the retailers, and I'm saying, well, let's just wait a little while. You know, the trading environment is not going to get better very quickly.
Since the beginning of the year, Woolies hasn't done particularly much, but it's everybody's favorite stock pick for 2017. Is it a mis- looking at today's results, is that a misguided bet for 2017 now?
Well, I think it's a very bold bet, quite frankly, because when I looked at the results today, and you can see the market was disappointed in Woolies as well. You know, the share price down almost 4%. Although having said that, there has been, I think, a little bit of preemptive buying ahead of these results, but there wasn't, in my mind, awfully much to cheer about. You know, I think David Jones sales were virtually flat. You know, Country Road was mildly negative. And I'm increasingly worrying, and I think you alluded to it, the fact that there's more of the sort of David Jones type product in the Woolies stores. And I know it's sort of a strategy to, you know, sell the best of Woolies to David Jones and vice versa. I'm not entirely sure the South African market is the right place for that experiment. And I think they're actually, you know, taking quite a big bet on it. And I think it's one of the reasons why the clothing business is battling. So, no, I personally wouldn't rush out and buy Woolies or any of the other retailers. I just sort of sense that, you know, as I was just saying, if your real earnings is going backward to the tune of 10%, even if the nominal number is only 2 or 3% down, you know, frankly, how can you justify a 17 PE, and what is going to turn it around? And I still say one of the biggest issues is H&M put out trading statistics for South Africa, and I think they had over R1 billion worth of sales, and
what?
That's basically for
out of like three shops.
I mean, well, there's more than that. Yeah, I think there's almost 10.
They don't have a massive footprint.
Yeah, and a lot of them haven't even been open so for very long. So I think that just bears testimony to me to the fact that I think the South African retailers trying to move themselves up the price point chain are getting it wrong. I think they need to look at H&M. And I think, quite honestly, the likes of H&M and, you know, Cotton On and so forth are really listening to what consumers want. They've got a wide range of product, good products at good prices. You know, trying to sell a shirt for 400 and 500 rand when the likes of H&M is maybe selling it for 300 and there's more variety, I personally think that strategy is really misplaced, particularly given the really tough state of the South African consumer. So against that backdrop, I respectfully differ with the guys who say it's their stock pick on a one-year view.
To look at you, Graham, and I hope you don't think this is unfair, but I wouldn't have thought of you as such a dedicated follower of fashion. That was an incisive analysis of what's going on in the fashion industry. I'm surprised constantly by you. As a dedicated man of international man of mystery, are you a regular City Lodge stayer?
Well, I have in the past, obviously, for business travel, and that's very much the City Lodge model.
Yeah.
A very tough operating environment, clearly. I can't think of a time when, off-cuff, when the occupancy rates were as low as 66%. You know, we actually quite like the story if we look 18 months out. We think, you know, June 2018 with the new African hotels coming online and sort of that dead capex that's been in the balance sheet for a while kicking into gear, we think it could be quite good. But it's like a Woolies, you know, 17 PE for a company that currently is showing virtually no earnings growth. It just looks a bit expensive. But I think it's a good business model. I think Cliff Ross and the team have done an amazing job at building the business. What they just need is a little bit of a break. I think the African operations will help, but I think you need, as we were saying earlier, a little bit of growth, a little bit of consumer confidence, a little bit of business confidence. And I think you could see, you know, 66% occupancy rate get back to 70, and then it'll look quite different. So yes, we quite like the story, but like so many good quality companies, it's just, you know, too expensive for us right now.
Graham Kerner with the Kerner Perspective.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, your number one news and talk station.
Welcome to The Money Show, brought to you by Old Mutual. Do great things. Lots of you saying you're not very impressed with the David Jones brand that you're finding on the shelves of Woolies. And it's just nice to have the variety. It's nice to go through. I mean, to my mind, and this is because I'm a bit of a shopping Luddite, as I would expose myself to be when I talk to the Truworths chief executive, Michael Mark, in just a moment. But so much of it looks the same. You know, it's got a different label in it, but it feels like it comes from very similar sort of influences. How's that for being very, very diplomatic? Coming up on the next Money Show is a really interesting young business person. On our Friday file, tune in for an interview with Kyle Schutt, who's the owner of Stratton Watch Company. He started the business through a crowdfunding initiative. Everybody's looking for money. Everybody wants to be funded. We'll talk to Kyle Schutt as to how he convinced people to give him money to start a watch company. Next time on the Money Show.
The Money Show.
Welcome to The Money Show. We're going to talk about the banks facing prosecution at the Competition Tribunal. Your Money Show FAQ this evening, the question everyone's really asking is, what do the banks actually do? What have they done wrong? And they've done something wrong. Very clearly, they've done something wrong, and some have done something more seriously wrong than others, and the Competition Tribunal is going to have to try and understand the very murky, shady, and complex world of currency trading. I think it must be a fraught place. We'll get an expert to explain that to us in just a bit. If clothing retailers depended on people like me, they'd all be bankrupt. Fortunately for them, there are far more people in need of retail therapy than I. Michael Mark, the chief executive of Truworths, on the line to us from Cape Town. Are people buying more or less, Michael? I mean, what are the patterns? I walk into a shop and I just go, oh, I'm too lazy to try, and I walk out, and that's why I look like a bag of rags. But are people struggling to shop, struggling more today than they were, say, a year ago?
Look, Bruce, definitely people are buying less and more carefully. The environment is tough. People are short of money. Economic growth is slow. So people are being more cautious, definitely, than a year before. The desire to shop, I wouldn't think, has changed. And that I reflect that because the footfall doesn't seem to be reducing, and also applications, people who are applying for accounts, is the same. But there's definitely a pullback on the volume of sales and the value of sales.
I mean, how creditworthy are your customers? You say the applications are at the same level, but are you approving as many as, say, a year ago?
Yeah, interestingly enough, using our scorecards, which, remembering, we connected to, there's 7 or 6, I think, I can't remember exactly, large bureaus in South Africa. We connect to most of them. So we have incredibly good information about new and existing customers. And yes, the credit criteria are such that the risk is not changing that much, slightly worse, of customers applying. But, you know, we in the past approved about 33%, between 30 and 33% of people who applied and rejected, 67 to 70 for years. And recently it's about 30%. So that's not different. Of course, what is different is of the 30 to 33% who used to get approved, about 90% did come and open the account. Now that has dropped significantly because of the affordability regulations.
And that explains then why you've got a bit of a spike in cash sales, more people using cash to buy because they simply can't get the credit.
No, that's not true in our case. Our cash sales are actually not any better than our credit, but the reason you're seeing those numbers of 20% growth, that's because Office is now included
in our numbers. Okay.
And Office, of course, is only cash and it's not comparable. Truist cash sales are similar to credit. That's purely and simply economic circumstances and environmental. The credit side, in these environments in the past, sometimes we've managed to carry the total sales through slightly better credit sales, ironically, in these environments, and affordability regulations are holding us back in that respect.
Tell me about Office, the UK business you bought last year.
Yeah, Office is great business. Look, timing didn't quite work in our favor in the sense that we bought the business at the time when the rand was approximately 20 or 21 to the pound. So in rand terms, the proportion of it that we financed through South African rand, which is about half, was affected by, you know, we got the currency timing, unfortunately, wrong. But the business has been through quite a tough time, similarly with Brexit and all the other surprises. They've also had quite a tough time. But I do think the early stages of our interventions and involvement are starting to tell now. And you did notice, I'm sure, that our sales growth in Office for the first 7 weeks on is 9% up in pounds, which is a good figure. And their stock turns improved from 2.5 to 3.5. Their margins are sort of not too bad. So I think we're getting really into that business now, and it's looking well over the medium term.
I mean, Office, as I understand it, is a business that kind of sells uniform. It's really workplace basics, and the UK workplace is a lot more formal than perhaps many workplaces in South Africa. And it's just a comfortable basics that people go to work in.
Now, funnily enough, it's not that at all. Bruce, Office is despite its name, Office is actually a young person's sports shoe business.
Why do you buy a business that lies? I don't know why I thought that. That's
yeah, no, because of the name you thought it. Yeah. But if you lived in the UK, you wouldn't see it in the way you do when you hear a name like that. So the truth is, in the minds of the UK and German and Republic of Ireland customer, Office is a young, fashionable, a shoe business for females particularly, but also males, 16 to 25, highly fashionable shoes, the majority of which, about 70%, are the major brands like Adidas, Nike, etc., on the fashion side rather than the active sports side. So it's really a very, very cool, with it, fashion shoe chain.
And I see big discounts. I'm online now, and I'm seeing Timberland boots, £98 versus £145. I get you now. So much more of what Woolies is selling in South Africa, they tell us tonight, that they are making here as opposed to outside of the country. They were forced by circumstances, the currency depreciated last year, to do more local procurement. Are you finding yourselves doing the same?
You know, it's a balance. We've tried not to go too volatile up and down because of the currency, because your problem with doing that is in the local market, and I suppose internationally, you develop relationships with your manufacturers, and what one doesn't want to do is service local manufacturers, and then when the currency turns against them, you sort of suddenly go abroad and drop them, because then you don't have long-term sustainability. So all of our local manufacturer arrangements, most of which are exclusive to us, are long-term. We very rarely go in and out the market with them. And they are about something like 40% of our business is clothing business is done locally at the moment. And that's mainly fast fashion or quick response. In other words, you can have the fabric ready and the production space booked because the factories are exclusive to us. And then we turn on the best sellers or the right colors, or we change styles depending on the demand of the customer at the time. That's the big advantage of doing it locally.
And in terms of kids brands, you've made some big acquisitions in local kids brands in the last year or two. And many people who are shopping resistant will happily spend money on their kids long before they bother buying themselves a new T-shirt. And that's got to be a really good sweet spot.
Bruce, that's exactly right. I mean, it's really exciting. You know, we've always had our LTD kids business, which is, I think it's a half a billion rand of sales. It's a really big business. But buying Naughty and Earthchild and adding them to our LTD kids business so that in our large stores we've got what we're calling the kids emporium of those three brands, and plus there's a lot of standalone stores, that really gives us a great positioning in the better end, high quality, young fashion, young kids fashion market from toddlers, newborns, all the way to 13, 14-year-olds.
I'm looking at this office business of yours online. What are the prospects of you bringing it here? Because the ranges are incredible. The brand variety is incredible. Do we have the sort of big enough market in order to absorb this sort of business in South Africa?
Yeah, you've picked up the exact correct profile of the business. What it differentiates it from the other businesses that are similar with the big brands in the UK is the variety, as you said, and it's all up market. And as I say, 30% is what we call made to order. In other words, the kind of shoes that you and your partner normally buy from stores that are not branded. So they have a unique position with better end shoes. Yes, that's right. We are bringing it to South Africa. We think we'll open 5, 6, 7, 8 office stores, or we're going to call it Office London in Africa, Office London stores, from about October this year onwards. And then we'll start rolling them out in the big malls.
Michael Mark, thank you. Chief Executive at Truworths.
The Money Show, FAQs.
And the most commonly asked question in the last 24 hours is all around what the banks did wrong. And 17 banks facing prosecution, massive social media outrage, barely registered by financial markets. Why? Well, no one's been found guilty of doing anything yet. The quantum of penalties are unlikely to amount to the billions that those seeking to interfere in the banking sector would like to see. So your question really, the Money Show FAQ, what did the banks actually do wrong? Stuart Theobald on the line to us from London, financial analyst and chairman of IntelliDex. What did they do wrong, Stuart?
Well, we don't know yet, Bruce. We've had a statement from the Competition Commission that they're going to prosecute the banks with the before the Competition Tribunal. We don't know exactly what banks have done wrong. The Tribunal statement makes reference to there having been some collusive practices in the setting of spreads over currency trades, particularly the US dollar rand trade. That they used the Bloomberg chat functions and even met face-to-face to try and manipulate the prices that were brooding in the market. That's what the Competition Commission has said in a fairly brief statement. It's difficult, really, to make complete sense of that.
But it's very Groundhog Day relative to very similar currency manipulation stories out of the UK 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago.
Well, I think you're talking about the LIBOR manipulation, yeah. Right? Which, well, so that's kind of different because LIBOR refers to the rate that banks are charging their customers. And it was determined by kind of survey of banks. So every day banks would be asked, well, you know, tell us how much you were charging customers today. And banks would fill out a form and send that in. And banks could manipulate it by just putting in a different number in that form. Now, the foreign exchange market is massive. I mean, South African rand US dollar trade is something like $90 billion worth every single day. There are, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of transactions with different prices set during the course of the day. To try and manipulate those prices is extremely difficult. Now, maybe there are some amazing bankers who are able to simultaneously affect prices in, you know, Singapore, London, Hong Kong, New York, everywhere that rand dollar is being traded. But it just seems to sort of stretch credulity a bit. So you know, I would want to see these allegations and the evidence behind them properly tested before a tribunal to really understand, you know, how this is possible and what the banks have actually done.
We do know that the banks are under siege at the moment. We do know that there's a huge amount of populist pressure on the banks. The president raised it in his reply to the State of the Nation address today, talking about transformation of the banking sector. And there is a strong suspicion as to his motives for being so focused on the banking sector. So here's the big question. I mean, is there any evidence that the banks actually manipulated the value of the currency? Or were they simply profiting on individual trades? Because those who dislike the banking sector intensely, and there are a handful of people like that, are trying to sell that particular narrative, that this is currency manipulation, this is unpatriotic, these are people who should lose their banking licenses and be sent to live on the 21st century equivalent of Robben Island.
Yeah, so the Competition Commission statement certainly did not say that. The statement refers to the spreads. But very quickly after that statement, some politicians got on to the case. And there was a statement from the ANC saying that the rand was manipulated. Now that's just not conceivably possible, because when a spread is manipulated, what's happening is that the buy price and the sell price are being fixed at a certain space apart from each other. So just like when you see rand quoted on a currency changer, you'll see how much they'll pay you for rand, but then you'll see another number, which is how much they'll sell dollars to you. And there's always a gap between these. Now, it's that gap that is being manipulated and kept wide. What the average between those two numbers is, that's not being manipulated. So the idea that somehow the rand was kind of trashed for profit, you know, there's just no way that could have been true in this case.
Stuart Theobald, thank you. Financial analyst and chairman of Intellidex.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, number one, News and Talk Station.
The Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual. Do great things. I don't like talking about personal stuff on the radio. I don't think it's particularly interesting, but I've been challenged. And I can't resist a challenge. So Matt says, Truworths is awesome. I bought a fleece there in 1999 and I still wear it today. Am I less fashionable than you, Bruce? Matt, I see your 1999 fleece and I beat you. Because I bought a Timberland fleece in the United Kingdom in 1997. My wife made me give it away last year. I'm still really grumpy about that. Worn out and not very good anymore. But it was warm and good and usable. I hate shopping.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Somebody else is going to look very cool 1997 style somewhere. Welcome to The Money Show. It's brought to you by Old Mutual. Do great things. And let's tell another personal story. I sat in a Cape Town hotel recently and I arrived at midnight. I probably only got to bed at about 12:30 and I was awakened out of the room again by 6 a.m. And as I was sort of like blindly packing my stuff out back up in the morning, something struck me that the hotel has to launder the sheets that I barely slept in, the towel I'd used for less than 6 hours. And something else that struck me was that the water pressure in that particular hotel, which is usually a bonus because it's usually pumping, had been turned right down to not much more than a sensible flow. But the water pressure was turned right down, which is a good thing because there is a huge drought in the Western Cape and Cape Town has reputedly got 134 days of water left in the dam. So sensible that they're doing that kind of thing. Clifford Ross, chief executive at City Lodge Hotels, are you dealing with water more aggressively than perhaps you used to, Clifford?
Good evening, Bruce. Yes, we certainly are. And as you said, here in the Western Cape, we have, probably some of the most dire situations with regards to water. We as a company have started an awareness campaign in every one of our hotels right around the country. What we also do is we have dual flush toilets in all the hotels. We do have water restrictors on the taps and on the showers. And what we've also done is in the new refurbishments and the new City Lodge hotels that we build, we are going for 70% shower-only rooms. We already have Town Lodge and Road Lodge, which only have showers. Mm. And, you were speaking earlier about the washing of the laundry and the towels, etc. We also have a campaign where we ask guests to please to consider.
I mean, do people comply with that sort of thing? Do people or people they treat hotel rooms a bit like they treat hire cars, not very well indeed, and sort of dump their towels on the floor and expect fresh, clean towels because it's a hotel stay and I'm paying for it? Or is that attitude changing?
That attitude is changing and changing very fast. I must say that the guests are really becoming aware of the shortages which we have in water, you know, right throughout the country. And, you know, our biggest generator of waste water is our laundries. So what we're also doing is we are piloting a grey water system where all the water which gets reticulated through the laundry is then used on the gardens and that type of thing. Because every one of the chemicals and the soaps and any of those things which we use in the hotels are all biodegradable. So therefore that water can be used for alternate uses, such as the gardens.
Okay, I mean, that's really good to hear. I mean, one looks at the environment in which you operate, and I used, you know, bed sheets for 5.5 hours, and they had to be washed in the same way as sheets that might have been used for 2 or 3 days. And you kind of, you feel a bit guilty about it, but it's just, yeah, sometimes it's just the way of the world. Your occupancy rate's coming under a bit of pressure. I mean, this time last year, you were sitting on 69%, you're back down to 66%. Is that a correlation of business confidence and average occupancies?
Yes, it certainly is. You know, we are disappointed with the results as far as the occupancies are concerned, but not surprised because in the 6 months to December, we had firstly the lead up to the local government elections, the elections themselves, the midweek public holiday which was declared on the Wednesday. You know, all of these things affect us where we have the majority of our business being business travel in South Africa. Also, the economy, as we all know, and I think consumer confidence is at all-time lows. And I think we're really feeling it on the weekends. The weekends are definitely very much softer than what they used to be. And that really just talks to the consumer not having the disposable income to actually travel on a weekend.
But if you go around, I mean, the airports, if you go to Cape Town, you fall over tourists everywhere. Are you not cracking that market? Are tourists sort of maybe, because of the strength of their currencies relative to the rand, perhaps staying more 4 and 5 star than perhaps City Lodge's very good 3 star, but you're not in that sweet spot?
We're certainly getting our fair share in the Cape. And, you know, I think we just need to mention that tourism in South Africa really is in one place and one place only, and that is in Cape Town and certainly the Western Cape. And we don't have that number of hotels catering in for the international tourist here in Cape Town. We have the majority of our hotels in inland and certainly in the Gauteng region, where we've got approximately 53% of our rooms.
Do you put rooms onto the sort of aggregator sites, the guys who offer discount stays and that sort of thing? Are you using technology to your advantage fully?
Yes, we certainly are. And we've also just actually on Sunday launched our new bid to stay website, which is for distressed inventory on weekends. And, you know, it's you as the guest. Go onto the website and you spin the wheel and you can get some really good discounts, up to 100% discount, and it really is the luck of the draw. So that we certainly are using to great advantage, and obviously putting it through on all the social media sites, you know, to get the word out there that there is the site where you can get these rooms.
Have you been able to measure the impact of something like Airbnb, which is revolutionizing the way people travel globally? In Cape Town, the stat I was given was there was something like, this was about a year ago, 20,000 beds available on Airbnb, 10,000 of which were available in Cape Town. That was the stat back then. Have you measured the impact?
We haven't actually measured the impact. There is a study being done currently. But, you know, anybody who sells a room is a competitor. So, you know, Airbnb falls into that. You know, we as an industry, you know, don't mind competition because I think competition is good. It keeps you on your toes. But the only problem which we have is that we're not playing on the same playing field. You know, there are no regulations and no laws governing something like Airbnb, and we believe that that is an area of concern and one that needs to be looked at by the authorities.
I mean, there is regulation in the form of the consumer. The consumer will very quickly reveal their likes or dislikes. I mean, that is the reality of the of a new generation of consumer.
Yes, that certainly is. That certainly is the case. But you know, we are competing with them, and if we're competing with them, we feel that that they need to play on the same platform as what we do. And you know, we have an enormous amount of regulation and legislation that governs any other type of accommodation except Airbnb.
Airbnb, it's revolutionizing the world. The chief executive of City Lodge, Clifford Ross, there are investigations underway. There are studies underway as to how that is affecting them. And, yeah, we watch the space with a huge, huge, huge amount of interest.
The Money Show. Personal finance.
Warren Ingram, personal financial advisor, executive director at Galileo Capital. It's Valentine's week. And did you get the roses?
I did. Thank you so much.
Excellent. I'm glad you got them. Cut the heads off. You know what that means, don't you? Now, listen, we're talking couples and money, and I think we need to set the mood. We have candles. We've got candles. Got no chocolates. We're not allowed to eat in the studio. Nice music. We need nice music. Romantic music.
Playing my hair
just
back.
Just pull me in. Hey, blowing it off. That's. I just thought, what is the cheesiest music I could do for romance? And that was Loving, a terrible sitcom of the 1980s. It was revolting. But now listen, I mean, this is quite serious because more and more people are sort of hooking up, shacking up, doing whatever it is they do instead of getting married. Maybe they'll get married one day, but kind of marriage is quite an outdated concept, and it comes with lots of legal nonsense and family pressures and all sorts of stuff. And so people move in together, and they're not necessarily thinking of the financial consequences of doing that before they actually move in, and it can be messy.
Exactly, and I think it's... I mean, you know, park the I guess the moral or religious arguments to one side, but you know, a lot of people would say, well, you know, you would test drive a car before you buy it, et cetera, and you know, so we're going to move in together and see how it goes, and then you know, if it goes well, we get married, and you know, it's probably in the beginning, in the early stages of someone moving in together, they keep their lives fairly separate, but you know, a year or two or three down the line, almost organically. Things start to merge, both you know, financially and I guess in a range of different ways. You know, it becomes practical to say, well, you know, if one of us is doing the grocery shopping more than the other, why don't we have joint bank accounts or do something?
You know, there's no such thing in South Africa as a joint bank account. South Africa is it's the most despicable failure. I don't know if it's a banking system thing or a regulatory thing, but you can't get a bank account in a couple's name or in two different names.
Sure, but I guess I'm saying, you know, practically that we open a account and then we chuck all our money in there, and
but still it's antiquated, and I'm shouting at the banks, bad banks.
Bad banks, but you're taking me off track now. See, I'm losing my train of thought. You know, I'm a male. I can do one thing at a time. So what happens is they start to merge their finances, and I think, you know, without malicious intent or you know anybody doing anything you know strategically to derail a process, that's just what happens. And then you know eventually it'll you know it progresses to, I mean, I think the sad ones are, for example, you know, we've got space, why don't we buy a puppy or a cat, or you know, and then you know, why don't we buy a house together? And all of those things are great until the relationship falls apart, or tragically, one of the two parties passes away in an accident, you know, something unexpected, and then all of a sudden, the complexities that they've created for themselves by trying to simplify life really just hit them, you know, like a ton of bricks.
I mean, if you've got young people, for example, in a relationship, and they're, one of them owns a property, and there's no will in place, for example, for their partner to inherit the property, and naturally that property then goes to their next of kin, who might be siblings or mum and dad or whatever the case is, and you find yourself homeless as a result of the fact that through no fault of your own and through nobody's intent, you're excluded from inheritance on that particular basis.
And you know, and especially if you for example, you know, contributed to the bond and contributed to the maintenance of the property and the rates and taxes, etc., over a period of time, you just end up with no legal basis to stand on, or you're going to have to really, you know, fight it now if there's not an amicable way of splitting things. But you know, even if there is, you know, if the will says, you know, the property goes to the parents, then if they say, well, you know, hang on, you know, you're entitled to half of the value of the house, that they effectively have to donate that to you, so they then become liable for donations tax.
There's a tax implication.
So there's a major tax implication. So it becomes quite complicated very quickly. And I think you know to me, a lot of that stuff we can simplify quite easily. Like everything in life, unfortunately, somewhere along the line you need to document the stuff and write it down and get a proper agreement in place. But so it's certainly not to say that you've got to keep your lives completely separate all the time. It's just a case of saying that you have to have a proper agreement in place.
Who are those guys who do contracts for virtually everything? Hoarders, don't they? I mean, could you get a hoarders cohabitation agreement? Are they that progressive?
I don't know hoarders at all.
They're part of Bidvest, and they do basic contracts for sale of assets and things. I wonder if there's something like a cohabitation agreement in Hoarders. But it's probably not a bad idea to say, go and see a lawyer. Hello, we were so much in love. Let's get a contract.
Yeah. And I mean, it's something that we would tell people to do before they get married. We would say, go and get an antenuptial contract and make sure that everything's documented. And so, you know, the same when you move in together is at least just have a cohabitation agreement in place that specifies all the stuff, especially if you're going to start merging your lives, which I almost think is inevitable.
And then at some point, I mean, the relationship will either go down a serious path and there'll be a commitment. There doesn't have to be a marriage. It becomes quite complicated, though, in terms of things like estate duties, in terms of you cohabiting and the property might be in one name, not the other name. And the cohabitor leaves the property to you in their will. What happens with donations tax and inheritance when you're not legally married in the 21st century?
Yeah, so as of this week, because I suspect it might change next week, but at the moment, you know, if a husband leaves everything to his wife, there's no donations tax implication in that. But if it's a, you know, a couple and they have no legal marriage, then you know, if one party leaves a portion of their assets to the other party, then they'll be subject to donations tax, and you can't get away from that. So it's something to note and to know about going into the deal, because you know what you can do is, for example, buy the property in joint name. So you can still do that, Bruce, even though you can't have a joint bank account. But again,
Kokesh wants to fight with me on this particular point. Kokesh in Sunning Hill, you can have a joint bank account in South Africa.
Yes, you can, Bruce.
Where? Why has it been kept so secret from my wife? Because she's very angry with you, with the entire banking industry, that we can't do this.
Oh, you can definitely have a joint bank account. I know many people, you might want to approach the banks and get a joint account.
No, but a bank account in both people's name with equal access, equal rights, equal signing power on the account. Not an account in one person's name with signing rights of the second person. Because, yes, it's not a direct joint bank account.
A joint bank account, absolutely. With two cards associated with it. A joint bank account.
But the account is in one person's name and there's a second signatory to it. It's a small thing, Kokesh, but it's not a fully equal 50-50 partnership in the bank account. One person carries the liability for that account.
Sure.
Okay, so it's not a joint bank account, Kokesh. It's a second card in an account.
No, I'm not talking about a secondary. So you could have your account, and you can get a secondary card to that account.
Mm-hmm.
That's completely separate. That's your account, and you can just get a secondary card to your spouse's account, to your account, and then you can have a joint account.
Gukesh, please tell my producer which bank you work for. I'd be very interested because I've looked. I've sniffed around. Maybe it's just, you know, when I go and ask questions in banks, people look at me strangely, like, why would you want to do that? Is it important to keep separate bank accounts? I mean, here I am wanting to put everything into a single pot because I'm such a good person and that's just the way it should work. But would you counsel against that, Warren?
Yes, always. from the point
King
of view...
King of romance. Yeah.
And even, you know, long-standing married couple, you know, with no prospect of on the horizon of divorce or anything. It's just very simply, for example, if you do have a joint account, let's assume that they exist, and all your affairs run through that account, what happens if one of you passes away? Because my view is that the bank most likely would be under a legal obligation to actually freeze that account for a period of time until there's a letters of executorship, et cetera, et cetera. And so now the surviving spouse is now left without access to money. So I would always say that you should definitely have individual accounts with a reasonable amount of money in both your names, so that you know what the one person can continue and function while the estate is being wound up.
And also just basic consideration, things like life insurance and stuff. I mean, you are in a serious relationship and a permanent relationship. It might not be marriage, but if one of you does disappear off the face of the earth, there's going to be a period of disruption and upheaval and dismay. Don't make it worth somebody's while to have you bumped off, but, you know, be considerate.
Yeah, and I think it's a nice one where going back to your property example, where one partner owns the property, and if the other person, let's say, is contributing to the bond, and they're not in any kind of legal marriage, then at least make sure that the person who owns the house, that that there's a life policy on that person's life, and that the other person is the beneficiary of that, because then you have none of the issues of worrying about a will or going through the probate process. It's a straight contract. The person's passed away, there's a nominated beneficiary, and you get paid out, and you can make it to the value of half the value of the house, et cetera, mm. or a larger amount, etc. But I think, to me, that would be one of the ways of simplifying what could be an enormously complex situation in the event of death, of course. If it's just a breakup, then you need that cohabitation agreement.
Warren Ingram, ever practical, but we're not going to play the music again. It's not very romantic. Warren Ingram, he's a financial advisor. He's an executive director at Galileo Capital. Very sensible, good guidance if you're shacking up.
The Money Show.
Small business.
Pavlo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator. Now, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because you keep teaching us about starting a business, finding the cash to get the business started, and you must bootstrap, and you must borrow from the friends, fools, and family, and you got, and that's great. And then the business is up and running, and now you've got 10 customers, and then a couple of them don't pay you. And then you're dead.
Literally.
The world
literally
ends. Mm. It's crying. I mean, it's a big issue in small businesses, surely.
Well, it's a big issue in a lot of businesses, but in the small business environment, Bruce, it's compounded because it's really, really hard to, let's say, use the courts of law to collect monies, especially if the monies owed are under 80,000-90,000 rand. And, in a single transaction, that's a massive transaction for a small business. It's a huge transaction. I mean, so mostly it's these small amounts that you just struggle to collect sometimes.
If I fail to pay my credit card or my mortgage, for example, it won't take very long for the bank to pick up the phone and say, sorry, hi, did you forget? And I can go, well, no, it's got no money.
You've got a very polite bank, incidentally.
And then they're outsourced to a third-party call center. And then the calls would get more agitated and more demanding and more difficult. And then the letters would start arriving. And then they start using language like joint and severally and things you don't understand and very, very quickly they would ramp up their efforts to get money out of you, and they would have many people in a chain who could chase after you, because that's the way this works. In the real world of small business, it's you trying to get your next customer, it's you trying to fulfill your orders, it's you trying to service your customers, and it's you going to those same customers and saying, excuse me, it's been 6 weeks, could I please have the money you owe me? That's awkward.
It's very, very difficult. And what's particularly awkward about it is that the gig economy, the freelance economy, is a growing piece of our business environment. It's a growing segment within the economy itself. And those relationships are often really built on quite a personal level. You are doing the selling, you're doing the delivering, you're forming the relationship, you're coming up with ideas, you're servicing a client. And when that money's not paid, it becomes really, really awkward. So I think there are a couple of things, Bruce, that one can take on in order to minimize the risk of not getting paid. And there are a couple of really smart strategies, some of them quite boring, but necessary, some of them quite smart and really clever.
Teach me.
Well, the first thing is to know your business. To know your business. You know, I recall one of the first businesses I bought, which I bought more by happenstance than anything else, and it loaded me with an enormous amount of debt, way beyond anything I ever imagined. Because the debt hadn't been disclosed and the individuals who sold it to me ran away, they went to go and live overseas. So I sat saddled with this business, looking at this business, saying, how do I fix it? I was selling product, in fact, fishing tackle and camping equipment that I was importing from various parts of the world, right through the country to probably about 1,200 odd customers, most of which were small independent retail stores. And what I learned really, really quickly is that if you don't become really good at understanding who your customer is, and if you don't stop trying to be everything to everybody, you'll never really get into the feel, the texture of what makes that kind of store a good operating store and therefore a good investment to issue and allow credit to be extended as opposed to just any other store. You walk into the store, you look at how the fishing rods are displayed, the lures are displayed, you look at the knowledge of the owner, you look to see if the owner's there. You start to develop a really good sense as to how serious this business is.
But you can't visit 1,200 suppliers across the country and still run the business because you're kippy alone, aren't you?
Yes, and that's where you start to then build systems. Because in a system, you're going to have something called a credit policy. You're going to have a way of when your representative walks into that store, you're going to ask them to tick six or seven questions that you might have on a sheet. And the sheet might say, is there dust in the window? Is the operator there? To what extent? How is your product being displayed? And once you start to get a sense of how that store's operating through a very simple checklist, which is, for example, a system, you can then get a measure as to whether you would extend credit, and you can start to get a sense of how serious that potential, because a customer is a partner in this instance, how serious that partner or customer really is.
How much respect do they have for you? I mean, and your product. That's, you know, are you their third in line customer? Are they, are you,
exactly,
you know, at the back of the shop, the front of the shop? Where are you? How important are you to them as to, that should be how important they are to you, I suppose.
Exactly. And then, you know, that system folding back into knowing your business and knowing what you want to be good at. As a small business, in my view, the extent to which you become specialist, the extent to which you become a thought leader, a project leader, someone with a really good insight into delivering a service that's valued and understood, one where you develop a good reputation and that's valued, those individuals are going to be paying you because they want the value that you have to offer.
Okay. At some point, though, there are too many customers for you to be sitting on the phone and saying, hello, is Johnny there? No, he's playing golf. It's Wednesday afternoon. Okay, I'll phone back tomorrow. Oh, no, he's gone to the doctor. Oh, no, his kid's sick. And you're chasing Johnny around the countryside trying to get Johnny to pay you, but Johnny came lately, and he is not paying you, and you're getting a bit grumpy as the person who's supposed to have this fabulous relationship with the customer. At what point are you big enough to start outsourcing the dirty work of collecting the money? Because you don't want to be spending all of the profit margin that you might be making on a transaction on paying somebody to collect it.
Well, you know, the outsourcing process, I'm a big believer in the outsourcing process because what I think it does, Bruce, is it allows you to focus on your core activities, your core business. So, for example, you know, as startups, all of us, when we start, well, we try and be our own techies. We try and be our own accountants. We try and be our own bookkeepers. And we try and be our own debt collectors. And it makes for very, very difficult. It makes it very, very difficult for you to focus on what counts as opposed to what doesn't count. And often you hear of someone saying, I don't see the wood for the trees any longer. That's where it begins. I see businesses doing 70, 80 million rand turnover, and that entrepreneur says to me, I can't see the wood for the trees anymore because he has not shed, or she has not shed, the habits that were developed at that stage. So before you can outsource, an outsource partner is going to turn around and say, well, actually, who are your customers? How well do you know them? What do you do? And how good are you at what you do? Because to collect a debt means that the debt needs to be valid. And for a debt to be valid, you've got to make a certain offer to a customer. The customer needs to understand what it is that you're offering. They need to buy that offer from you. It needs to be contracted. If you don't know what you're doing, you can't write a contract. It needs to be supported by a back office system. In other words, you need to be able to invoice effectively. You need to be able to manage your debtors and your debtors' days. You need to be able to produce evidence of the fact that this transaction is due and paid for. And that's when an outsourcing partner will start being interested. The next thing is, they're looking for volume. If they're looking for volume, they're looking for 40, 50, 60 customers to collect on your behalf versus 4 or 5. If it's 4 or 5, it's going to cost a little more, but it's a starting point. And then the third thing is, they're looking at the quality of your customers. If your customers are not people who, well, if they don't have to pay and they can get away with it, because really there's no point in chasing them, it's unattractive to an outsource partner.
Valuable as always. Pavlo Fotidis with Auric Business Accelerator. So much of it also is how you run your business, how you present yourself, how you deal with your customers. Do they treat you seriously, or are you the sweet guy who's not going to push them too hard? You're more keen on impressing them than they should be impressing you, and they sort of push you to the back of the queue. How does psychology play into this? More on that with Pavlo in just a moment.
The Money Show.
Small business.
So tell me about the psychology of the relationship between you and your customer, Pavlo Fotidis from Auric Business Accelerator. The way they treat you, why would they put you at the front of the line when it comes to paying their bills and not at the back?
Well, if you present a very clear and good case around the service that you're offering, for example, Bruce, and that then goes to the proposal that you write, or it goes to the way that you invoice. It goes to the promptness of how you deliver that service. But most importantly, psychology is everything in life. But here's the thing. Don't go big with an unknown customer. Do you remember about a year ago, we did a show, when the deal is big and it lands in your lap, beware, beware. Because those big deals, if A, you don't have the muscle to be able to deliver on them effectively, you're going to get very tardy payments if you get paid at all. Because the customer's argument is going to be, well, you didn't deliver, and you didn't deliver against the spec, and you didn't meet the service level agreements. If the deal is too big, and it is so big that should you not be paid, it's going to completely collapse your business.
Yeah.
There's an argument to be said, well, that's kind of, that's playing a little bit of roulette. Because if you don't believe you can necessarily deliver on it, you take it on, you take that huge bite, you suddenly realize it's too big for you, you in effect are losing your business. So this thing called greed, this thing called impatience, which are built into your psychology, are the things you've got to resist and fight back.
Yeah, no, it is big. And the temptation to change the shape of your business, to change the future, to change your fate, because you may never get this great opportunity again. And that's where the psychology is crazy.
Completely. Because wealth is cumulative. Growing a business is cumulative. You know, on Friday, not this recent Friday, the Friday before, I went to go and have a look at a fascinating business. It employs 642 people. And it makes very comfortable lounge chairs. Let me put it to you that way. Bruce, it's taken ages and ages to build. In fact, the very first show we did this year, we spoke about 52 innovations, 52 steps. Mm. In other words, one a week. Eventually, that becomes 400 over 3.5 odd years. That's how a business is built. It's not built on the back of one big deal.
But okay, when it comes to the dirty job of collection, you can't outsource it because you don't have the money or you don't trust people or whatever the case is. You're running a small business. You've got to make that phone call.
Yeah, you do. You do.
What's the tone? Hi, it's me calling from the other side.
Well, okay, so look,
Adele, yeah.
All right, so the legal process is a tough process. It's a rough process. If you are dealing with an astute customer, they can play a game. They can lead you down the garden path. Our courts, in truth, are really built for big businesses, and they're built for government. It's not built for the small business environment. So you've got to sometimes be a little unconventional. If you've tried the right approach, a persistent approach, a consistent approach, nagging has a huge amount of value. That's the first thing I will say. Nagging, if it's done properly, if it's done politely, if it's done consistently, has a huge amount of value. Going and visiting your client and sitting in the lobby area until you can see who you need to see in order to get the payment made has a lot of value. And you know, one of the big benefits nowadays is often if you sit in the lobby of your client as opposed to in your office, whilst you're waiting and you get connected onto the internet, and if your systems are all in the cloud, you could probably undisturbed get a hell of a lot of work done. It's not a bad strategy to follow.
I mean, it's a long time ago. I sat in a reception area of a company until I got paid. It was very effective. It became quite embarrassing. People were saying, what are you doing here? And I told them.
I'm waiting to get paid.
Yeah, I'm waiting to get paid. They thought I wasn't in the country, but I am. Here I am.
But there's some very unconventional strategies you can use too that are entirely legal. And I'll give you an example of one, Bruce. I was owed some money in one of the businesses that I built. It was in the earlier days of my career. This business was a turnaround business. I had bought it for a rand, and we desperately needed every single cent that we were owed. And this particular individual had a business. They were a customer of mine. They were sitting in Rosebank in Johannesburg, and they would not settle this debt for the stock I had delivered. And I pleaded and I begged, and every time I did, yes, it's coming soon. The post is in the mail. You know that old story.
Mm-hmm.
So one fine Saturday morning at the end of the month, which was a peak period of activity for this particular business, I sent my girlfriend at the time with her best friend to the shop where they proceeded to try on every single pair of shoes, every single bikini, every single pair of shorts, every single t-shirt, pushing things aside. We'll take these, we won't take those. And right at the end, after about 3.5 hours of trying on all these outfits and creating a complete palaver in the store, simply walked out and said, thanks, but no thanks. And by the way, Pablo sends his love. On the Monday, the fax machine, it was in those days, went off with proof of payment. It was a very effective way to covertly get your money collected.
Pablo Fatidis, the revolutionary. Fantastic. Thank you, Pablo, very much indeed. Pablo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator.